Clytus, I'm bored. What plaything can you offer me today?
Is that War Rocket Ajax? To bring back his body?
And welcome to War Rocket Ajax. It's the internet's most destructive comic book and pop culture podcast, and we are your hosts. My name is Chris Sims, and with me as always is my co-host, Mr. Matt Wilson. Matt, how are you tonight?
I'm all right. I accomplished something that I will be discussing in our Checks and Rec segment that I am maybe the most proud I've ever been in my life of. No, that's exaggerating, but I am pretty proud. Because it's not something I normally do, so we'll talk about that very soon.
Before it's like a teaser. Teaser for a show that you're already listening to.
Yeah, we're getting complex with our teasers and stuff here. But before we get to any of that, we should say who our guest is this week. It's a fun one. We're talking to one of our favorites, Ted Anderson, the writer of many My Little Pony comics.
That's right. You may remember Ted from his first appearance on the show a couple years ago. In the intervening time, Ted has written an issue about pro wrestling in My Little Pony. And he's written an Equestria Girls special, which if you are a Movie Fighters listener, you will know Matt and I have a lot of questions about that we will try to get answers to in our interview segment this week. So that is going to be a fun one. But before we get into that, I think we have some business we need to take care of.
That's right. We've got to name some our newest Patreon patrons and give them thanks.
These are people who have headed over to patreon.com/warrocketajax to help support the show. Throw a few bucks our way. We appreciate it. Help us keep the lights on and pay those gimmicks they keep sending in the mail called bills. To quote Stone Cold Steve Austin.
CougarLife.com.
Listen, right. I will do a Cougar Life ad. There's an amount of money that I have in my head.
Hang on. We're still looking for we got to the $1,200 mark this week. We want to have a reward for all our patrons when we hit 1,500, but we don't know what that should be. So we want your suggestions for what that should be. If that includes doing word for word the Stone Cold Steve Austin Cougar Life ad, we'll do it.
We will do it. Maybe it's finally time for us to do our episode by episode mini home improvement podcast for backers only.
It won't be many if we're going episode by episode, but
that'll be at 9,000.
All right, here are some backers that we need to thank: Kevin Palma.
Oh, thank you, Kevin.
Rafael Gaitan.
Thank you, Rafael. Oh, he's a good guy. I have hung out with him IRL.
Benjamin Smith.
Thank you, Benjamin.
Callum Smith.
Thank you, Callum.
I wonder if they're related.
It's a Luke. Very common name, Matt.
Yes, they are.
Your name is Wilson. You should know that.
It's true. Luke. All we got on that name is Luke.
Well, thank you, Luke.
Nathan Prather.
Thank you, Nathan. Long time listener.
And Greg Woods.
Thank you, Greg.
Those are the newest Patreon patrons. We appreciate their support, and we appreciate the support of all our other patrons. They are helping us out immensely in keeping this show going. All right, Chris, now that we've done that, let's do some checks and recs. All right, Chris, what do you have to check in with this week?
Well, my check this week is that I found your knife, Matt.
You found my knife?
Found it in my back.
What did I do?
How long have we been playing Marvel Puzzle Quest?
I don't know, months,
I have been playing it since, I think, August.
Yeah.
I have not been a member of an alliance in that time.
Oh, yeah. Here's the thing about that. I don't know how to invite people to alliances.
Okay. That's fine that you don't know how to invite people. I did not even know this existed until one of our other mutual friends told me he was in an alliance. And I was like, oh, who's in it? And he was like, Matt.
I also frequently forget that I'm in the alliance because it's just like not something I ever look at.
Unbelievable.
But yeah, there are like six people in the Alliance. I think you're the seventh. I did notice that you joined today.
Yeah, no, no thanks to you.
I'm sorry.
I'm very upset.
I should have never kept this from you.
I finally joined Matt's Alliance because there's an Ultron thing going on right now that you have to be part of an Alliance for.
Yeah. Look, so, you're saying this as though I started the Alliance, or I would not have invited you if I didn't know, if I knew how to do it. But I don't, and I didn't start it. But I am sorry.
All right, well, Matt, what is... Look, I don't like things that specifically exclude friends of ours. And you can ask Ken Lowry, who will never be on the show.
That's true. That all holds up. That all checks out.
Matt, what is your check this week?
My check is that this week I have been serving in a role that I don't normally serve in, and that is repairman. I'm about to get real in the weeds on my home life here. Chris, you will know that I guess it was Monday night, or it was Sunday night, because you were asking me about Extreme Rules. You were sending me some messages about Extreme Rules. And I G-chatted you back. I'd love to be watching it. Actually, I wouldn't love to be watching it. I watched it Monday. It kind of sucked.
Well, there were a couple of really good matches.
But it mostly was a...
We should say, by the way, congratulations to King Wade Barrett.
Yes.
Winner of the crowned 2015 King of the Ring.
That's right.
Very exciting.
But I couldn't watch Extreme Rules as it was live because around that time, our dryer just completely stopped working. It had been not doing very well to begin with. But it got to the point where you would push the start button and it would just go, make that sound and not start. And even if you could get it to start, it would run for maybe 15 minutes and then stop in the middle of the cycle. There were several things that I thought that it was. Eventually, it became very clear that the motor had burned out in the machine. So I was like, all right, I can pay $400 and buy a new dryer, or I can pay $100 and buy a new motor and try to replace it. So that's what I did. I went and I bought a motor on Monday. I took apart the entire dryer. Like, you have to take the entire thing apart, which includes taking out the drum and the belt from inside the dryer. And I installed the new motor with great difficulty. I found some videos that showed you all how to do everything, installing the new motor. One thing those videos did not say is that there's this little plastic piece that attaches to the back of the motor that spins around. Sometimes it can melt onto the motor and will not come off, which means that you have to tear that thing to pieces so you can pull the motor out. So I had to take a drill and literally drill that past plastic piece to tiny bits to destroy it and take the motor out. I had to get another one of those wheels. I had to put in the new motor, attach those together. And then tonight, just before we started recording this, I put everything back together. The only thing I haven't done is put the back on the dryer yet. That's the last thing I have to do. But I took that thing, I put it together, I put the drum back in and somehow got that aligned right. And then I plugged it in, I pushed the start button, and it started with zero difficulty. It is running like a top. It is silent. It is not making tons of noise. And it's like angels from heaven started singing when that dryer started running. I was just like, I accomplished this. It was like, it's like the feeling you get from beating a video game. But I actually did a real thing.
I was sure that I was going to have to try to draw a pony for this week's sketch for Patreon backers. But now I just want to illustrate the phrase, it was like the feeling you get from beating a video game, but I actually did something.
So that's what I've been doing this week. I've been fixing a dryer. And by God, I did it. All right, Chris, those are our checks. Let's make some recommendations. What do you have to recommend?
My recommendation, I think I am going to set a War Rocket Ajax record. You know that we have a tendency to recommend games that came out usually around 2 years ago. We get around to them.
That's true, yes.
I am recommending a video game that came out in 1999.
Castlevania Symphony of Night.
That's a really exciting one. Look, that game's good. That game holds up. No, I am actually recommending Wario Land 2 for the Game Boy Color. I've been getting more and more into retro gaming lately. You know, we've talked about on the show how I've been watching Game Center CX and listening to the Retronauts podcast, reading Jeremy Parrish's really fantastic Anatomy of Game books. And I've also, you know, lately, but I don't want to just lay in bed thinking all the time. So I've been checking out some of the stuff that's available on the 3DS Virtual Console. And a long time ago when I first got my 3DS, I bought Super Mario Land 2, the game that introduced Wario. And I had never actually gone in and really played it and beaten it until a couple months ago. And since then, I've just sort of been working my way through the Wario Land series because they're like $5. So, you know, it's $5. I play a game for about 2 weeks. I hate every second of it because they're old and difficult. And then I move on. But Wario Land 2 is really interesting. And just for the record, the Virtual Console version came out in 2012. So we're still right on track.
Yeah, we're still right around two and a half years ago.
The weird thing is how long the Game Boy lasted. The Game Boy was around for so long. Like, I don't think the Advance came out until I was in college. So the Game Boy was around for, like, 10, 12 years. So Wario Land 2, for being a game from 1999, is really interesting because the previous game and Super Mario Land both kind of take their cues from Mario 3 and Mario World, where there's an overworld map. And you move around it, and you kind of unlock new stages, and there's secret stages and stuff to go through that way. Wario Land 2 plays start to finish very linear. Like, there's no overworld map. There's just you finish a stage, the next stage starts. And it tells you what you need to do in that stage. Until you beat the game. When you beat the game, and you beat the final boss, it kind of shows you that there was a whole bunch of other stuff going on in that game that that there were a whole lot of different branching paths to it that you don't know about until you have finished this very linear game. And there's like one thing where in the very first level, like Wario is sleeping and when you press a button, he wakes up and you start the adventure. If you don't press anything and he just stays asleep, you get an entirely different set of stages that, like, takes you to a separate ending. All in all, there's, like, five endings. There's a bunch of stuff that you could have, you know, like I did. I completed that game, I thought, without ever getting to any of these secrets. Which, you know, 1999, you're into the PlayStation era by that point. Right. So this is not something that's necessarily revolutionary. But to kind of get that on a Game Boy Color game was something I was not expecting, that I actually found really fun and rewarding for this game that, you know, I downloaded for $5 because I liked Super Mario Land 2. It's really interesting. I'd love to see, I know Jeremy Parrish is doing a site called Game Boy World where he's writing about every single game released for the Game Boy in order of release. And I would love to see what he has to say about Wario Land and Wario Land 2. But he's not going to get to those for, like, 8 years.
Right.
Because of what he's writing. If you've never played it, I'm not going to lie, it is a very frustrating game in a lot of ways. Like, actually playing it, the Game Boy, for lasting a dozen years, was not really a great system. It was not a very fun system in a lot of ways, because it was dealing with severe limitations. But it's very interesting.
I can tell you right now, the Game Boy's shelf life was more about battery battery life than anything else. Because that was the downfall of, like, the Game Gear and the Lynx, you know?
Yeah, I actually had a Game Gear. Like, I know we've had conversations about how I have this weird proletariat reaction to the Genesis, but, like, I had a Game Gear. So I'm I was a day one customer for every version of the Game Boy up through the 3DS. The Game Gear was impossible to play. The whole point of the Game Gear was, like, oh, you know, like, the whole point of a portable system in general was, oh, you can take it on trips. And, right. You know, we used to go to Ohio, you know, every summer and every Christmas and every Thanksgiving. And, like, that's a, you know, 10, 12-hour car ride. Like, the Game Gear is not going to last. Like, it's a good thing I liked reading.
The Game Gear would last for 2 hours, maybe.
Maybe. On off batteries. 6 AA's.
Yeah.
6 Arne Andersons. Matt, what is your recommendation this week?
My recommendation is a movie that I don't believe is streaming anywhere. I actually found it in a Redbox. And I've been wanting to watch it for a while. I've been getting recommendations for it for a while from listeners who knew that I liked You're Next, which is a movie I recommended previously. This movie is from the same director and the same writer as You're Next. The director is Adam Wingard. I don't remember the writer's name. But the basic premise of the movie, The Guest, is that the family of a soldier who was killed in combat, one of his colleagues, one of his brothers in arms, one of his fellow soldiers, comes to visit and stays with them for a while. And then they kind of realize that he's not who he says he is, or he's not quite what they expected, or he starts showing a side of himself that he doesn't reveal right away. There are two kids in the family. There's a teenage daughter. Like, I think she's like 20, actually. So she's maybe home from college or getting ready to go to college. And then there's like a high school age son. And he has a lot of like interesting interactions with them. He sort of helps the son kind of get over being bullied at school, but he's very aggressive about helping him about that. He helps the girl get maybe a little more confidence with dating, but also, like, helps her get a little more backbone. Like, he actually does some stuff to help this family, but he is not a good guy. And that becomes more and more apparent throughout the movie. I don't want to give away much more of it than that, but I'll say that there is a sequence at the end of the movie that takes place in a high school that is decorated for a Halloween dance that is absolutely fucking great. Just the atmosphere of it, the way it's shot, the lighting, everything about that sequence is great. And it's presented in some ways like a horror movie, but it's not really a horror movie. It's more of a thriller. Kind of like You're Next isn't really a horror movie. It's more of a thriller. But it's presented in this great way. The music is fantastic. You know, when I talked about It Follows on the show, I talked about how much I liked the music. I like the music in this movie almost as much. It reminds me a lot of kind of the 80s horror soundtrack throwback bands that exist now. Perturbator is one that I've become familiar with.
Love, yeah, quite a bit.
That music sounds a lot like that. And it adds so much atmosphere to the movie. And also, speaking of It Follows, the lead actress from It Follows is the daughter in this movie. It kind of feels weird watching it maybe in the first act, and then it all kind of like gels and clicks right away. And it also does that thing that It Follows does where there are some things that happen that make you think that there are things going on under the surface, but that are never really explained and are kind of there for the audience to figure out. I really dug The Guest a ton. So if you can go grab it, if you're a person who's into horror movies, thrillers, that kind of stuff, so not you, Chris.
Not me.
But if you're into that kind of thing, lots of people recommended it to me. I watched it. I thought it was great. So you may have the same experience. All right, Chris, those are our recommendations. Let's talk about some of this week's comics. We're going to do three variations on a theme this week.
It's a very thematic week, at least for what we read.
the theme is loving adoration, a love letter to Crisis on Infinite Earths. DC Comics put out three comics that are love letters to Crisis on Infinite Earths this week.
Yeah, and I will say, like, I liked two of these comics. Well, I loved one, I liked one, and I didn't hate the third, to be quite honest. But I feel like this has to stop.
Okay, so would you want to start with love, like, or neither?
Let's do love first. Let's talk about let's do our convergence roundup.
Wait. Oh well. Okay. Well, one of the comics that we loved. This is not the one we straight up loved. That was a love letter to Crisis, but we did love the Doc Shaner, Jeff Parker, Shazam book so much.
So good.
It was fucking wonderful.
Yeah. It's exactly what I thought it was going to be, and it is exactly what I wanted it to be, which are, it is very rare that those two things happen at the same time.
I'm going to go so far as to say it is the reason for convergence.
Yeah, like, it's all worth it now. And there have been good convergence tie-ins before. I talked to, did I talk on the show about how much I loved the Atom one?
Yes, that, you did talk about that, yeah.
One that Tom Pyre wrote.
The Question, like, one was very good. The Flash comic I read, I liked, but I think this is the polished gem of convergence. And I think the fact that Shazam has been trending on Twitter for the past 2 days is full on evidence of that.
If we get like one thing out of Convergence, like if we get like one ongoing series out of Convergence, I would love for it to be Jeff Parker and Evan Shaner doing this version of Captain Marvel, of Shazam. Excuse me, I forgot we don't call him that anymore.
Who would have thought that Shazam, Captain Marvel, would be as important of a character as he is in 2015? At least in like these big DC events where, you know, he's in this very well-received Shazam one-shot for Convergence, and he's a huge part of Multiversity. Mm-hmm. Like, it's crazy.
I mean, I will say, I liked this more than I liked Thunderworld, and I liked Thunderworld a lot.
Yeah.
I feel like this is the book that is... It's doing a lot with its premise. Because I have read most of the Convergence tie-ins. I don't think I've read all of them because I'm not caught up on this week's yet. But I've been writing those Bottle City travel guides for Comics Lines. And to be honest, a lot of that is just because, you know, I know a lot about the post-Zero Hour Gotham City, like off the top of my head. But I'm trying to keep up and read them so I know that who's involved in what and who's fighting and where the story's going. Because none of the actual fights... None of the premise of this book that we're going to see, like, different versions of these characters fighting each other, none of that is happening in Convergence. I think that's all happening in the minis.
Yeah. Like, I don't even know if I have anything to say about Convergence number 4. Like, I feel like it's the issue where the main series went completely off the rails.
Yeah. That book is about people from Earth 2 World's End, or Earth 2 Future's End, in Scarteris, I guess? I have no idea. It's interesting which books are kind of trying to... The different ways that a lot of the books are trying to deal with their premise of, okay, these characters just spent a year under a dome where nobody had any superpowers. And I feel like there's been good stuff in a lot of other books, but this is the best. The idea of Ibak and Savannah kind of plotting that entire time, of Taki Tawny being off the grid and coming back because he's been investigating things. What has Tawny been investigating under the dome? The kind of twist of who Ibak and Savannah are, the moment where everybody gets their powers back, you know, that has been the weird thing about Convergence is that we have seen the moment where characters get their powers back. I have seen it. and if you're reading all of them, you've seen it like 20 or 30 times at this point. And no one has done that moment better than this book does.
Yes.
Which, and again, there are books out there that I really like in Convergence, but no one did that as well as Jeff Parker and Doc Shaner did.
Yeah, that Shazam book is fantastic. One thing I want to say about the main Convergence book, there's like the big moment of issue four is a character turn. Like there's a heel turn in here. There's a reveal that someone's been evil all along. There's nothing behind it. There's no power to it. Because we haven't, I guess because we haven't been reading Earth 2 World's End.
Yeah, I guess.
It just like, it feels like it's supposed to be this big moment, but I'm just like, okay, I guess that's what's happening now.
Yeah, like, Convergence is very frustrating to me, just as a reader.
Yeah.
But this Shazam book, go get it.
Yeah.
Because it's a hoot, and if, I wrote this on Comics Lines, if there is any team that I want to see doing Shazam versus Steampunk Batman, it is Jeff Parker and Doc Shaner. Like, it's going to be awesome.
Okay, let's talk about the Crisis love letter book that we really liked, that I loved, The Multiversity Number 2.
I think you probably liked it more than I did.
I thought it was great. I had no idea how Morrison was going to pull all these threads together from all these one-shots and finish this story that it started in Multiversity Number 1. And by God, he did it. I think he pulled it off beautifully.
I feel like he did and he didn't. And I think that's a thing that is kind of the plague of Grant Morrison's career. And we should say that this is Grant Morrison and Ivan Reis doing the art. I was very apprehensive going into this issue because I've at least liked and frequently loved everything about Multiversity. So this being the end of it, a lot of pressure. Like, a lot of pressure on this to live up to everything I wanted it to be. And I it didn't quite do that for me. Now, I will say, I loved the end of it. The thing that that I've written about before that my friend Scott always says about love it or hate it, Crisis on Infinite Earths is one of the best DC comics of all time because everything's in danger and everything dies at the end. Like, everything goes away at the end. The actual DC universe ends in Crisis. And he has always said that the only way to top that is to literally put the reader in danger. So getting this book where the heroes of a bunch of, the 52 realities form a team to fight the reader is pretty great. I'm not going to lie.
It's called Operation Justice Incarnate.
Which is ridiculous. Which
is great.
No, it is great. It is great and ridiculous. And Captain Carrot's on it, and Nuclear Batman.
The stuff with Captain Carrot in this issue, I loved so much. Like, the fact that characters in this, like, this comic that had to accomplish so much in, 40 pages? I guess that's how long this is. They still got, like, he still managed to put in these little character moments. Like, when Captain Carrot didn't have his head.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it. I loved so much about this comic.
I really liked that. I really liked, I think I IM'd you, hashtag fuck yeah, Jared Stevens, the man called fate.
Yeah.
He showed up.
I loved the reveal of the big bad. The gentry is defeated, right? Mm-hmm. All these horrible, insurmountable, it's that video game thing, right? Where it's like, you defeat the thing that you think is unbeatable. And then you move on to the big boss, and he's surrounded by 10 of those.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happens when Great Vathlo shows up. And it's just like, yes. I love that.
Yeah, but at the same time, like, this doesn't end it.
No, he specifically says there's got to be a sequel.
Yeah, which is a funny bit of meta commentary. Like this, you know, big thing ends with there being a sequel. But you know what this reminded me of, and one of the reasons that I think the ending frustrated me the way that it did. Because I will say, I like this comic a lot. It is, you know, I highly recommend it. It's very enjoyable to me. The Ultramarines story in JLA from, what was that, 99?
Yeah.
Like, forever ago? Like, 98, 99? The Ultramarines story in JLA ends with the formation, like, the Ultramarines disband, and then it ends with the formation of the new Global Guardians, which is Knight and Squire show up, Warmaker One shows up, Jack-O-Lantern is there. Like, all those characters kind of show up. The end of that story is the formation of that team. That team never shows up again until JLA Classified number one, where that team is destroyed. Like, no one touches that team except Morrison. And more, like, he ends this story with a lot of potential, and then no one does anything with it until he basically, you know, kills them off in to launch a crossover. And that crossover being Seven Soldiers, essentially, because JLA Classified 1 through 3 is a weird prelude to Seven Soldiers, which, again, would not happen for another year.
Right.
So I feel like Operation Justice Incarnate, I have a feeling that we are never going to see these dudes again.
But that's
we are
not,
never
going to
see this team again.
That's not this comic's fault.
It's not this comic's fault, but it's the same thing. Like, unless Multiversity number 3 comes out next month, when is this, like, when are we going to get this story?
I mean, that's fair, but like, I don't think that means I shouldn't enjoy this comic that we got, because there might not be another thing.
I mean, Matt, I would not take it away from you.
Please don't. Please don't take it away.
Right. I do like there's a nice little thing on the cover where in all the issues of Multiversity up to now, like the cover has the little sidebar with the 52 worlds and the Earth that it takes place on is always kind of brighter than the others. The ones that it's not on are darkened a little bit. All the Earths are in play in this issue, which I think is a nice little visual touch. There's a lot to like about this comic, but it does not end. And then I feel like it's never going to end.
I'm okay with that. I have no problem with that. Okay. Let's quickly talk about Justice League number 40, which is the other Crisis love letter comic from the week. I liked it. There are some neat ideas in it.
There are neat ideas in it.
I also think it is kind of unnecessary.
Yeah, it's a weird artist jam issue, too.
Yeah. I mean, there's
Kevin McGuire, Phil Jimenez.
There's a two-page splash by Phil Jimenez in here. That is kind of worth the cover price.
Yeah, I mean, like, Kevin Maguire's stuff is awesome, because Kevin Maguire is awesome, you know? Like,
I also want to note that this was sent to me in a DC Comps pack with a Magic Mike cover.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You got the variant.
I got the Magic Mike variant cover.
Interesting. I just want to stop talking about Crisis forever. I never want to talk about Crisis on Infinite Earths again. And you can't, because it's literally the most important thing in DC Comics history after Action Comics number one.
But this is
Action Comics volume one, number one, excuse me.
This is like talking about Crisis a lot to set up a Dark Side story.
Yeah, I know. And I know how the last Dark Side story in Justice League went. And how I was mad about that for 2 years.
Yeah.
There's an idea in here that I talked to Kieran Shiak about it, because he actually really liked it, and I am like weirdly 50-50 split on it, which is when you find out that the anti-monitor is named Mobius.
Right.
And the Mobius chair that Metron has is
that was his chair, yeah.
Which is interesting. Because we have to stop calling that guy the anti-monitor. That's the dumbest name in comics. Like, all apologies to Marv Wolfman. I love Tomb of Dracula. But the anti-monitor, like, that is somehow dumber than his original idea of him being the anti-librarian. The Anti-Monitor is a terrible name. So if we're going to call this guy Mobius the Anti-Monitor, I feel like that is at least a step up.
At least it gives him a name.
Yeah, he has a name. I kind of like the idea of him being someone like Metron, who was, you know, taking in knowledge from the entire multiverse and then decided that it needed to die. I think that's a cool idea. On the other hand, I also feel like this is Barry Allen having a reason for wearing a bow tie. You know, like, that it's called the Mobius chair, so there must be a Mobius out there whose chair it was, when I don't think that's a necessary addition to the Mobius chair, you know?
Yeah.
And there are examples of that happening in comics that I really like. I think it's hilarious that the Emerald Eye of Ekron existed in Legion of Superheroes comics for like 30 years, and eventually you finally see the Emerald Head of Ekron, where the eye comes from.
Right.
That's a really good gag. I just, like, I saw it and I was like, I did not smile. I did not frown. I just said, oh,
I don't,
okay.
I don't care about the chair, really. That's not why I liked this issue, or what I liked about it. What I liked about this issue was sort of the meta-commentary, which is Geoff Johns basically saying, look, there have been too many crises. We're to the point where, like, crisis is kind of a meaningless word. We've done this a lot. So let's address it a little bit. And look, Geoff Johns was directly responsible for, I think, two of those.
Yeah, like, in the... There's a big spread of Crisis on Infinite Earths. There's a big spread of Zero Hour.
Yeah.
Infinite Crisis and Flashpoint.
Yeah.
Two of those are Geoff Johns books.
Two of those are Geoff Johns. I get it. And it's also weird that Final Crisis gets left out. But
well,
whatever.
Yeah, Final Crisis gets left out, and they use the word convergence and not the word multiversity.
Yeah. That said, I kind of like I thought the point of that meta commentary stuff was I thought it was well taken. Like, I felt like this was the closest Geoff Johns has gotten to, like, talking to directly to me as a reader, certainly in this Justice League book. So while I could really not care less about the chair, you know, who cares? I thought that some of the, like, winky, hey, we know this is a DC comic and we know that we can't keep pushing that crisis button over and over again was, I don't know, I thought it was interesting.
The one thing that really bums me out about this comic, and it's a thing that you and I have talked about before, is that this comic ends with the Anti-Monitor, Mobius the Anti-Monitor, saying that he wants a war with Darkseid. Both of those guys are supervillains. Neither one is a superhero. I just want to see superheroes fight supervillains.
The Justice League appears in this comic not once.
No, they're in one page.
They appear in, like, you know, flashbacks to crises.
The New 52 Justice League appears in a flashback to the first, you know, the battle with Darkseid at the beginning of the New 52.
Yeah.
That is it.
The only character we see, like, in anything even somewhat new-ish is Orion.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oof. Like, honestly, in some ways, I would have preferred to see a Justice League Magic Mike comic in this.
And again, like, I think there's good ideas. But at the end of the day, like, we've had, you know, our chief complaint, yours and mine, about Justice League is that it's a book where superheroes fight superheroes and nobody fights supervillains.
Or supervillains become the good guys.
Yeah. And fight more supervillains.
Yeah.
Like, now it's like, yeah, it's the Dark Side Anti-Monitor War. And it's like, neither one of those guys is a superhero.
All right, that's going to have to do it for our comics reviews for this week. Chris, we got to get into our interview segment. Let's do it. Let's talk to Ted Anderson.
Let's do it. Joining us for the program this week is someone who's returned returning to the show after, I think you pointed out, it's been 2 years since the first time you were on.
Almost exactly 2 years, yeah.
He is a comic book writer. You may know him from My Little Pony Friendship is Magic number 29, which is the pro wrestling themed issue.
Which, Pony Mania 29, baby.
Pony Mania play button is what it should be now, I think. And also the Equestria Girls Holiday Special 2014, which is why Matt and I have brought him, because if you listen to Movie Fighters, you know we have so many questions. Ted Anderson, welcome back to the show. Ted, how are you doing tonight?
I am great. It is a great pleasure to be back again and probably be unable to answer a lot of those questions, because, man, even I don't know, like, the pony timeline and the pony multiverse. There's an actual pony multiverse now, which just baffles me.
While Matt and I were watching the Equestria Girls movies for Movie Fighters, I kept having the question of where are their parents? Because they are children. They are high school students. They go to a high school. We see adults working at the high school. What we do not see is anyone's parent. And you actually show some home life. You show people that they actually have houses.
It's true. So it's like the whole parents question is, first of all, kind of fraught with controversy, as are so many things in the pony world. But some of the ponies have parents that have been confirmed and seen on screen, and some of them have even spoken. Some of them have not. It's more or less common fanon that Applejack's parents died sometime when she was just a filly, which is why she only lives with her big brother and her little sister and her grandma.
Ted, I don't want to cut you off, but if you use the word fanon again, we are going to end this interview. I will Terry Gross and Gene Simmons this shit like you would not believe.
with due cause, with full cause. I completely understand that. But yeah, so it's a very weird situation when it comes to the Equestria Girls universe, because they do have parents, and we see them in like the main pony show and in Equestria 1, Equestria A, whatever you want to call it. But they're in that weird age space of being sort of adults in the sense that, like, they can own businesses and do, you know, and be adults. But at the same time, they're also kids because they're having to learn very basic lessons about friendship. So in the main pony universe, it sort of makes sense that we only occasionally see their parents. But yeah, when they're in the high school, suddenly they are definitively high school kids, which changes the relationship significantly. And it's a little bizarre. And there's even a little joke about that fact. There's a point where they're talking about, so the whole premise of the holiday special issue kicks off where they're deciding to have a series of sleepovers at everyone's houses, sort of to build up to the holidays, which is the only way I could refer to them.
Before we get to that specifically, I want you to take a moment for anyone who listens to this show but maybe doesn't listen to Movie Fighters, for anyone who listens to this show but does not spend literally all of their time watching shows made for children, which is what I do.
And me.
And you. Matt, I think, is the adult in the room.
I watch some shows for children. Just not all of them.
Matt looks up from his listening to Serial to let us know that I occasionally watch a show made for a child.
Matt, I deign to do such a thing. Yes.
For anyone out there who is not familiar with My Little Pony, which we talked about how you sort of got into My Little Pony, and you were for a time.
Go ahead.
You were, for a time, the world's most famous brony.
I will wear that crown for as long as I need to.
As long as you happily keep getting work.
And then happily remove it.
Yeah, but you were, if people want to hear about that, they can go listen to your previous appearance on the show from 2 years ago.
Right.
But you were working at NPR, and like me, you had seen this show and thought it was very good. And that's kind of how you got started, and then you wrote a couple of the comics. So that is the backstory. For anyone who doesn't know about Equestria Girls, I would like to hear you explain that. Because you, I think, have at least a slightly more insidery perspective than Matt and I did going into those DVDs.
A little bit. So we have our show, My Little Pony, Friendship is Magic, also known as Generation 4, because it's the fourth sort of major iteration of the franchise. And it has no one really does.
That's inside baseball. That's what they call it in the hallways.
I'm giving you a peek behind the curtain here, people. A peek behind the curtain. And that's magical talking ponies in the land of Equestria, and we've also got other talking critters and dragons and griffins and things like that.
A very nebulous line of what creatures are and are not sentient.
Oh, even within the main show, it's so bizarre. There's one episode that starts off with, you've seen this, you know what I'm talking about, Chris, but it starts off with Applejack having to, calm a stampede of cows, and then it turns out the cows can talk. Like, the cows are people, but for some reason they're also kept in pens. And why would they keep
for
cows?
For some reason, Applejack owns them.
Yeah, why would they even have cows in the first place?
So now you have a slavery conundrum.
I don't even want to get into the politics of Equestria. Like, if you start looking at it, it becomes this bizarre totalitarian state ruled by an immortal godhead that is unquestionable and once banished her sister to the moon for 1,000 years. It gets crazy. It gets dark in the dark corners of Ponyville. But yeah, so you have your world of Equestria, and no humans. Like, that's the crucial part. Like, no humans are not a thing. If anyone who may have watched previous generations of Ponyville or previous generations of the show, there were occasionally humans that showed up. None of that. Then, after season three, they had a movie where they're like, there's that line of dolls called Monster High. And there's that Barbie stuff that we keep hearing about. And there's all these other toys that are human-shaped. Let's make human-shaped pony characters. How do we work that into this franchise as it stands now? And what they came up with was there's a parallel universe that the ponies can get to through this magical mirror, which I don't think its origin has ever really been fully explained, and only works occasionally or when the plot demands it. And you can travel through it, and it's a parallel universe in the sense that all the pony characters in Equestria exist there, but as humans, and with skin tones the same as the skin, like the fur colors of the ponies, to sidestep any questions of race, very smartly, very wisely on their part. And so there's an equivalent of every character there in a high school setting. So Princess Celestia of Equestria now becomes Principal Celestia of Canterlot High. And then all the other characters are students, and most of the upper-level characters, like Cheerilee, the school teacher, is now Cheerilee, the school librarian, and stuff like that. And so we have this human parallel universe equivalent of Equestria. And so Twilight Sparkle, in the first Equestria Girls movie, travels there and meets all the equivalents of her friends, human Pinkie Pie and human Rarity and so forth, and then helps him defeat Sunset Shimmer, who was a pony, who went to this Equestria 2 or Equestria B or whatever, and apparently didn't have a counterpart there because otherwise there'd be two of them. So
I think she killed her.
It is kind of
heavily implied in that movie.
It's kind of plausible. It's kind of a Jet Li the One thing where, like, she kills off the other one and becomes more powerful as a result. So that's pure speculation.
According to the second movie, there's another humanoid Twilight Sparkle hanging around.
I wasn't sure if you'd seen it, so I was going to bring that up. But yeah, the stinger on the second movie is that there is indeed a human Twilight Sparkle and a dog Spike, an actual dog that doesn't talk, apparently, in Equestria 2. So who even knows how that works?
All right, here's our other big question about those movies.
Because
Equestria in like Ponyland is a whole world, right? A whole, like, it's huge with tons of horses.
And yes and no. It's never entirely established whether Equestria is like the name of the world or just the nation, because there's also been references to the Griffin Kingdom and Saddle Arabia, which I know.
At the beginning of the second movie, like Twilight Sparkle comes back from some like diplomatic mission. I remember that.
Yeah. Like, there's the Crystal Empire, which is a separate empire from Equestria, but still populated by talking horses, and they're on good diplomatic terms. I don't know how this works.
It's basically 10 times more complicated than Dragon Age.
So, okay. But it's at the very least a nation, right?
Yes, yes.
Then,
it's a full-on nation.
Then, in the alternate world, Princess Celestia gets a massive downgrade from sovereign ruler to principal of a high school.
You know, it is a step down for her, I gotta say.
So we were like, is the whole world just this one town? Or is there like a Paris and a Berlin and a Beijing and an Australia? Or is it just one town?
I wish I knew the answers to these questions. I really do. Here, oh, actually, I can make this even more confusing, though. So I also
– great.
One of the other issues I wrote. So, okay, so there's an episode in season four, where they get sucked into the pages of a comic book that Spike bought, where they become the Power Ponies. And this is like a comic
amazingly
book.
Amazingly, I have not seen that one.
Oh, it's great, because you should. Like, it's a straight-up superhero thing with ponies, and the villain is the main EAC, which is like, she's got kind of the color scheme of the Joker, but has crazy living hair. Like Medusa, any one of the Medusas in comics, and has all, you know, the crazy laugh and planning to take over the world with, I think, mind control shampoo. I forget. So that's a comic book within the world of Equestria, like Equestria 1, main Equestria. And then for one of the earlier issues that I did for part of the 2014 annual, I did a thing about the maniac in that world traveling to the human equivalent of that world. So there was, he met like the human maniac, and then they fought and then became villain friends and all that stuff. And then like the closing shot was, we kind of pull out and see human Rainbow Dash reading the Power Ponies comic in which this happened. And she says to herself, a four-legged maniac, this comic is weird. So there's like, there's within this parallel universe setup of Equestria A and Equestria B, we have a subset of parallel universes with superhero ponies.
So here's what I'm thinking, Ted. when the inevitable pony crisis on Infinite Earths happens.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that.
Look, I'm never going to write My Little Pony comics. I'm not versed enough in it. So I'm giving this away for free. Ted, you can have it. Hasbro, go nuts. There's a very, like, a realistically drawn scene, right, in a stable where, like, the monitor horse is in the stable. The mono horse.
The Manator.
Thank you.
Oh, okay. That's pretty cool.
And it's just, it's stomping its feet, it's one hoof down on the ground to count the number of universes there are. And it's just like one. And then you see that universe, two. And then you see that universe. And that's how it determines the number of pony universes there are, by horse counting.
I'm going to put this out there. And unlike Matt, I would like to retain this. So if you know, Hasbro, IDW, if you guys want it, you can contact me through Ted.
Copyright Chris Sims 2015.
Copyright Chris Sims 2015. Multi-horsity.
For one of the annuals involving Equestria Girls, I did pitch like a thing where the universes started crossing over, just because I wanted to have, I had like the image of like a human Rainbow Dash jousting while riding on like Pony Applejack, because I thought that would be hilarious. That unfortunately got nixed, but I mean, come on, that would have been great.
You didn't want to have like Rainbow Dash flying so fast that she started disintegrating?
Like, oh, Barry Lord, Allen? Give me strength. I've got to save the universes. No. Human Rainbow Dash and Pony Rainbow Dash in a race around the world for charity.
Look, the Flash of Two Worlds cover would be like so easy for that.
Why didn't I think of that?
I did not know this was going to turn into us writing the next, writing this year's annual. Well, here
we're just inserting ponies into every big DC event. That's easy enough.
Okay. So at what point then does Nightmare Moon cut off her own face and wear it as a mask?
Well, like, I was going to make an Emerald Twilight joke, but that works just as
well. I missed the obvious. That, okay. Sorry for stepping on the bit. That would have been great.
All right. So here's my question, Ted. Like,
yes.
I don't know how it is with the main book. the regular ongoing My Little Pony series, which, by the way, I don't know if it'll still be on sale when this goes up, but it's currently on sale on Comixology, and I can at least say the Katie Cook and Andy Price issues are actually really, really fun, and everybody should check those out. But when you're doing a Coaster Girls, like, or even when you're doing the main series, did they like give you a book? Did they like fax you over the PDF that's like, okay, here's how this works. Here's what you can do.
The show Bible, I guess you would call it.
They did not. I've never received a show Bible. And I don't know if, I mean, some ideas have been either nixed or like, oh, you should change this to that, or like, you can't make references to this. So, for example, I've got an upcoming issue. This is an exclusive now. This has not been announced. This is War Rock, must credit War Rocket Ajax.
Well, hang on, I'll open up my air horn app for the exclusive.
get the dredge siren going. I've got an upcoming issue with Zecora that involves Zecora.
Exclusive
2015. I've got an upcoming issue with Zecora, the zebra, who's the only zebra we've seen so far. Like, we've never seen any other zebras or got any reference to like zebra civilizations or whatever. I'm guessing partly because it's hard to talk, it's hard to come up with dialogue because she always speaks in rhyming couplets, but and I had all these references to like, you know, oh, a little bit about, oh, here's where she came from, and she hasn't seen other zebras in quite some time, and travel like that. And all that kind of had to be nixed or muffled, at least, just because they have to leave the possibility open of eventually maybe doing something with zebras or that sort of stuff. And then the comics is not the place to debut that particular subset of stories. So
what?
That stuff, I know, no, I mean...
Well, the thing is, I know that in the Doctor Who comics that have run in, like, the Doctor Who magazines and stuff, like, there will occasionally be stories where they will, for the TV show, which is obviously the thing that reaches the widest audience, it is the core continuity, like, occasionally they'll just, like, be like, okay, yeah, this plot from the comics was good, we'll do that. Like, this plot from the novels was good, we'll do that. Hmm. At least I think that is how it has happened. But is there, like, an actual thing when you're working on a property like that that's still kind of a going concern? Because I imagine that, like, if it's G.I. Joe or Gem or, you know, one of those, like, there's no Gem show on right now.
Right.
Tragically. There's no G.I. Joe show on right now. Like, is it something where, you know, they have to sort of bank stuff just in case they get around to doing it on that core continuity? Like, is that how it works?
To the best of my knowledge, I tend to pitch a little more, not cautiously, exact actually. I like to pitch stories that are a little bit more sort of about the stuff in between the toes of the main universe. You know, in the cloven hooves. I like to pitch things that are a little bit more about just exploring two characters that never happen, who have shared any screen time, or what might be the backstory of this one character. I like to pitch that sort of stuff rather than the bigger world spanning, you know, oh no, war with the Griffin Empire, that kind of stuff. And so I feel like maybe I'm not seeing that as much because I'm just not pitching things that could potentially be rejected on that basis. I honestly can't really speak one way or the other about whether there are ideas that have been turned down on the basis of, oh, we're already going to be doing this. Well, they did – okay. Actually, to be fair, I did pitch one story idea where they just said, oh, this is a little too similar to an episode in the upcoming season, so no dice. But that was just a one-episode thing. It was just sort of a one-off thing of like, oh, this plot is too similar to an upcoming episode plot. But that's about it.
You got to do the episode where everyone was a luchador.
Yeah. Oh, that I am honestly still surprised that they let me do that. I am so shocked that they allowed me to get away with the wrestling episode for so many reasons. So yeah, the wrestling episode, the wrestling issue. I'm very proud of this. I'm so happy that it happened.
I want to peel the curtain back a little bit.
Oh sure.
Do you peel a curtain, Matt, or do you pull a curtain? Because I've been mixing up metaphors all day.
You could peel a curtain if you moved it a certain way, but usually I think you would pull a curtain.
But I do want to say, during the writing process of this issue, I did get an email from you that was like, hey, is this how wrestling works?
I did. You were one of two wrestling experts I consulted. The other was a good friend of mine, a local cartoonist who I knew was a wrestling dude. And you were one of two people that I contacted. Like, I still remember kind of the way I put it was like, I didn't set out to create the most Chris Simsiest story I could have, but that's where I've ended up. So yeah, I wanted to run things by you and just see, first of all, is there anything egregiously wrong? And then on top of that, is there anything that I could add that makes it more wrestling-y? So yeah, let me give you a little bit of the creation story for this issue. I am not actually a wrestling fan. Like, I didn't grow up watching it. I didn't even have any friends who were really into it. I was one of those kids who poo-pooed it as like, oh, don't they know it's all fake? It's so stupid. It's all made up. Those kids who watch wrestling are idiots.
Mimo, you were reading comic books.
Oh, I was totally getting into the X-Men. You know, like, I was like, yeah, a world that hates and fears me because I can shoot lasers out my eyes, metaphorically.
Which are also not real.
Yeah, completely. Yeah, and it took me a while to kind of get what it was about wrestling that, like, it's the same reason. Okay, like, I've learned through long experience not to crap on other people's love of something just because I don't get it. Because I am demonstrably within a fandom that gets a lot of crap from people who don't quite get it. And wrestling is part of that. I don't want to judge anyone for liking wrestling because it's a completely different thing. And standing up and saying like, oh, wrestling's dumb because everyone knows how it's going to end and that they're just actors. It's the same as like standing up at a magician's act and saying, oh, that lady's not getting really sawed in half. Or like, oh, that deck of cards isn't really a normal deck of cards. It's just as pointless and as stupid to destroy it's not even an illusion. It's like an illusion of an illusion. That people are believing in voluntarily.
The thing that I always say, because like it is the year of our Lord, 2015, and there are still people who will be like, you know, wrestling's dumb because it's fake. Like, the thing that I always go with is like, yeah, you know, Game of Thrones is not real either. Like, there aren't for real dragons. I'm sorry. I hate to have to be the one to tell you that.
Christopher Bird, who writes Mighty God King, he had this great article a while ago where he was talking about wrestling. I mean, one of several articles he talks about wrestling. And he was quoting somebody else when he said this, but it's a great way to put it. Is like, professional wrestling is a LARP where the audience is playing the audience and the wrestlers are playing wrestlers and everyone's in on it. And like, I don't know who originally said that. I forget. He was paraphrasing somebody else, but like, that's the best way to put it, because the people in the audience know that they're playing an audience that isn't in on it, and the wrestlers know that the audience knows that they aren't real either. But you go along with it because suspension of disbelief is what is an underlying tenet of all fiction, and it's a necessary thing to enjoy anything. I am at a point now where I still don't watch wrestling. I still don't get into it. I am not going to hate on anyone for enjoying it, because Lord knows I have no ground to stand on there.
What, if you're not a wrestling guy,
what compelled me? What force, what strange idea possessed me to do this? I still don't know. I honestly don't know. I think at some point I was just like running through ideas in my head of like, you know, what would be the most ridiculous possible thing I could mash up with ponies? And professional wrestling obviously tops that list. And I was like, you know what? I could make this happen because I, like the Pope, am in a position to canonize. I can make things true in a very limited way.
I think that is the first time any guest on the show has said the phrase, I like the Pope.
It's one of many qualities we share, along with my fondness for extravagant hats.
Until we get a bishop on the show. Which I'm hoping is Bishop Don Magic Juan, but
he's an archbishop.
Is that like an arch nemesis?
I think so.
But yeah, I mean, I was at the point where I'm like, you know, I wonder if I could plausibly combine professional wrestling with ponies. And then at that point, it was sort of just like a mental challenge of like, how could I come up with a story that actually works as both a wrestling story and a pony story that both wrestling fans and pony fans will enjoy? And then it was just like, oh, well, now I have to see if I can do it. So I came up with the best possible story I could think of, which is the most unlikely character having to fill in for a wrestling match, which is, of course, the sweet and kind schoolteacher Cherry Lee having to fill in for her twin sister, who has never before been mentioned on the show and probably never will be, because I just made her up for this issue, which is the other thing I'm surprised they let me do. Filling in for her sister, Cherry Blossom, as the masked mayor. in the original version of the pitch, like this pitch went through several revisions. In the original version, there was a lot more like fake Spanish added onto everything. Well, real Spanish, but added on top of everything. So like she was, what was the original name? Yegua Furiosa, which just means like furious mare. And I think I even referred to it as like Lucha Caballo wrestling or something. I don't know. It was dumb. Like it was removed for a reason, mostly. And then at that point, it was just like, you know, I think it's actually work as a story. And so I just kept kind of pitching it. So I shouldn't say that I'm completely unfamiliar with wrestling, because I do have the slightest amount of knowledge possible. I was one of several people who was a freelance editor on a book about the history of professional wrestling in Minnesota for the Minnesota Historical Society Press. So it's about Vern Gagne and the AWA and it, you know, leading up to kind of the final showdown with Vince McMahon and ending on the... Oh, what was it? It was the AWA had some counter event to face off against like the first WrestleMania in the 80s. Anyway, so I was familiar with the basic ideas of wrestling, you know, kayfabe and heels and faces and building heat and that kind of things. And I knew enough about it to be able to more or less kind of fake my knowledge of it. And if I can brag for a second, it's paid off, because as one anonymous editor on TV Tropes mentioned, this was a pretty accurate depiction of kayfabe in comics.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, one of the interesting things about it for me is that, you know, this is, and look, you know this, this is not an insult, but this is a comic for tiny babies.
It is. It's true.
And you break kayfabe on page 10. Like, you have them go, oh no, it's fake. Like, we don't really hate each other. We're friends and we train together.
It's true. And like, it was a very delicate line I wanted to walk, where I don't want to just say outright, oh, it's completely made up and you're going to win the belt no matter if you just like trip and fall on your own face as soon as you step in the ring. I wanted to actually give some weight to the wrestling side of it, and you need to train and physically work out. But at the same time, that was also partly to cover my ass and make sure that nobody thought that the ponies were actually, you know, snapping each other's spines when they threw each other on the mat.
So many disappointed children just reading that comic and then throwing their John Cena wristbands in the trash.
I just, you know, metaphorically told them the truth about Santa Claus, like, to several thousand children all over the world.
Well, the thing that gets me about this is that, and this issue came out a couple months ago, right? Mm. It came out in March, yep. I believe.
March,
so,
yeah.
If people are just hearing about it now, it's really fun. It's My Little Pony, Friendship is Magic 29. But I'm going to go ahead and spoil the plot. The heel, like the champion that Cherry Lee needs to wrestle, shows up and like insults and threatens her to kind of give her the motivation to go out and win, which is hilarious when it is revealed at the end that it's all fake. Like, what is Cloverleaf?
Cloverleaf, yes. Which I chose because it's an actual wrestling move and it's a plausible pony name, but everyone has now told me I should have called her Snapmare, which...
That would have been good. Cloverleaf, I think Cloverleaf is good because you don't want it to be obvious that she is, what is her name?
Cherry Blossom. Or you mean that she's Iron Hawk.
Iron Hawk, yeah. She's just a jerk. Like, she's like, hey, check this out. I'm gonna smarten up this kid, brother.
And she completely lies about the fact that she is Iron Hawk as well. She's just like, yeah, no, I'm not a wrestler. No, it's all just a ruse to get these two sisters back together and being friends. Yeah. None of it makes any sense, as most pony stories do. You know.
I do wish that the wrestling ponies would have been like literally twice as large as the other ponies and no one ever mentioned it. Because having met pro wrestlers in my time, they are very big.
Yeah, the one that shows up at the very end, the Iron Hawks, heretofore unmentioned tag team partner, Steel Buns, is of course that giant level of pony. But that was just like a one panel gag, basically. It would have been this was originally pitched as a 2-issue thing as well, and I wish I would have had 2 issues to flesh out a lot of the wrestling storyline and have more actual wrestling in it, and have giant wrestling ponies everywhere. It's true, but
look, there is nothing that is more pro wrestling in 2015 than getting a 2-issue story done in 1 issue. We gotta hotshot this angle, brother. We gotta get this done by Payback.
Yeah, Yeah, so wrestling ponies. Oh, and the other half that came in when I was writing this is like, oh, I now have an opportunity to put any pony that I want in a luchador mask. Who do I want to do that to? And of course, the answer is Rarity, because Rarity is my favorite pony. And the results are adorable. I bought the original page from Jay Fosgate, who's the artist, who's a phenomenal artist, by the way. He's just started doing pony issues, and he worked on his first two issues were two of mine, and he's phenomenal. His stuff is gorgeous. And I bought the original page from him, and it's adorable. It's great.
Rarity, who wrestles under the name Diamante Elegante.
Yeah, that was the one bit of Spanish that remained in the, the naming set. Just because, like, at that point, what other name can I go with for her? Because Diamante Elegante.
Here's a serious question about these. Because you write other comics as well. But I think right now in your comics writing career, you are probably mostly known for these issues of the My Little Pony comics.
I'll tell you the truth. I am only known for the pony comics because that's literally all I've done so far. But that's why everything else that I'm working on right now is pitches or webcomic ideas or side stuff like that.
Well, on that note, maybe it's time to switch over to asking some questions from our listeners on Twitter.
Well, why don't we go ahead and do that, Matt? And if people want to get in on that, if people want to get in on these little interviews, these little chats that we have every week, how can they go about that?
What they need to do is they need to sign up for an account on a website called twitter.com. They can follow HighMindedMW. No, they can't. That's not my name right. anymore. It's the Matt D. Wilson now. And the ISB, that's Chris. And wait until Thursday night at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time for us to put out the call for questions. Now, while they're waiting for that, they can find little tiny babies and tell them that all the things they love aren't real.
But guess what, kids? You're all going to die eventually and decompose in the ground.
Okay, that one went a little darker than I did.
Yeah, sorry. I'm in a bad place tonight.
When it becomes Thursday night at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time, 6:30 Pacific, stop ruining the dreams and hopes of little children and wait and see if Chris or I have put out the call for questions for our guest, and then ask the questions similar to the ones that you are about to hear right now. And the first one I have is from Tales to Enrage, our friend Greg Black, power listener, I think is what he is now. He wants to know, Ted, were you given access to any real ponies for research purposes? For the My Little Pony comics, and once you get to multi-horsity, pony-versity, and you're using like real, like astonishingly real looking horses in your stories, I assume you'll have to go find some real horses for to see their movements and behaviors.
Yes, I was given several ponies, and they were delicious. Thank you.
Dark.
I've never actually had to study pony behavior. I can tell you that much. I looked some stuff up on Wikipedia. the joke, as it were, of the wrestling names. There's the character Iron Hawk, because the hawk, you see, is the part of the horse leg anatomy that is equivalent to the human heel. So it's the heel, the hawk. Ah.
Seems like a face character would need to be called Snout at some point.
Oh man, you're right. Or wait, is like muzzle? What is the term for horses? Now I got to look that up. Man,
yeah,
well, they're sequel. Yeah, there we go.
Maybe muzzle is the right way thing. Okay, Euchrid on Twitter, Ned Smark would like to know. This is a question for all of us. If you had a cutie mark, what would it be?
Now, Matt, do you need me to explain what the cutie mark is, or are you?
I have a general idea. It's like the logo. It's like the logo on their body, right? It's their birthmark.
Yes. Yes, yeah, okay. It is. It's the little logo thingy that appears magically that sort of explains what your special talent is. And oftentimes, this is maybe my favorite element of the entire show. Oftentimes, once you've gotten your cutie mark, you have a party called a cute señora.
which is a bit of terrible Spanish that they did like. That's
look,
from the show.
I'm familiar. I'm familiar with the Care Bears. Okay, I know this whole thing.
Basically, yeah.
Ted, what would your cutie mark be?
I mean, as boring as it is, I had someone draw me a picture of my spirit animal once, and it was a horse with a pig face called Piggy Pie. And that one's Cutie Mark was just a comic book. So as boring as it is, that one seems to work okay. Maybe maybe a mouth that constantly talks because I jabber on forever. There we go.
I am like multiple reasons I don't like hearing that.
What, the mouth that talks forever?
No. The part before that. Let's never speak of it again.
Chris,
Matt,
what would
yours be?
It's like asking me what I would get if I got a tattoo, which I can never decide.
It's more like if the universe gave you a tattoo.
Yeah. I mean, if I was choosing my own tattoo, I've always said that maybe I would get quotation marks on each of my open and closed quotation marks on my wrists. But if the universe was giving them to me, maybe like a Bojangles logo. Or an ice cream cone.
Chris, ice cream cone's pretty good.
Chris, what would yours be?
You should definitely get open and closed quotation marks tattooed on your wrist so that when you're being sarcastic, you can just hold your hands up next to your head.
Yeah, that's real funny. I guess that's actually less funny now that you can't see it.
Anyway. That would be great. Mine would be a bat, obviously.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
Our good friend Jen Vaughn once drew me as a pony. Again, I no, this was not a commission. I did not pay Jen for this. It was fun, and she gave me a word balloon, which I think was really cute.
Oh, yeah, I like that. Arthur Wyatt has this question. He's got some background for his, too. I've been idly planning out a Judge Dredd My Little Pony crossover for a while now. If Hasbro went insane and approved absolutely any crossover, what would your dream crossover be?
Ooh. Wait, so beyond the scope of just the Judge Dredd My Little Pony crossover?
Yeah, any crossover, anything you wanted to cross over the ponies with, you were given free reign to do. Who would you cross them over with?
Oh, man. I mean, Judge Dredd My Little Pony does sound pretty good, just because I imagine it being like, it's like the untold tales of From the Cursed Earth, where, you know, Dredd was walking around and he stumbles into this verdant, lush valley with talking horses, and they're all like, "Hi there, welcome to Ponyville. I'm Mickey Vine."
I think Dredd would have to be dosed with some kind of like drug to make all this happen. But sure,
exactly. Well, and this is where he would get his cutie mark. Clearly, he would get like a justice symbol, a judge's badge.
You guys joke, but like we do live in a world where Archie versus Predator is happening right now.
No, this is the pitching process. I mean, like, this is me, guys, right here. Just listen, Hasbro executives, please, for the love of God. I don't know. I mean, it's kind of obvious, and I think it's been done before. Everything's been done before in fan art. I would think that a My Little Pony Powerpuff Girls crossover would work pretty well. I mean, obviously you got the Lauren Faust connection on both sides, and the thing where they can both pick up objects despite not having like fingers. I would like to see those worlds collide because they'd both be kid friendly. They'd be amusing. They'd be ridiculous. You'd have crazy shenanigans, and like a lot of other cartoons, you would have Tara Strong talking to herself in two different voices. So
I say, do a My Little Pony WWE crossover animated movie in the style of the Flintstones and Scooby-Doo movies.
Oh,
Matt,
would you have
like the wrestlers as like wrestlers, like as people? Or would you have like they did in
the Flintstones one? It might have to be an Equestria Girls crossover.
Where it would be Vince McHorse.
The pun names are so terrible.
There would be Triple Horse. Hunter Horse Helmsley.
Yeah.
Dave Batista? Horse?
Vince McMahon. Vince McMahon. That's what it would have to be. One would you do? Would you have like wrestlers as people or wrestlers as horses?
I think the wrestlers still have to be people. So, again, like I said, maybe it's an Equestria Girls crossover. I don't know. All right. The next question is from Tharvos. they ask, what is your opinion about the relationship between Spike and Twilight? Some comic of them for the future.
That's a really apt question, for reasons I can't get into. I like their relationship as being more or less siblings. I mean, I like the idea of Twilight and Spike kind of not exactly growing up together, but I mean, Twilight was there when he hatched, basically, and they kind of they've always sort of been together in the sense that, like, even when they're arguing, they are clearly the closest friends you can have. And I like them just sort of being that sibling, having that sibling bond where they are always clearly on each other's sides, in the sense that if anyone else comes up, that's the bond that they have that links them together forever. So, yeah, nothing funny in that answer, but I do like that relationship for the two of them.
Okay.
I do always think about that episode of Home Movies, which is one of the best cartoons of all time, where Brendan and Melissa and Jason are filming a fantasy movie, and Melissa is the dragon sorceress who's like, yes, this is my dragon, my friend forever, and I own him. Just always think about that scene when those two are together.
All right, I think this one's going to have to be our last question. It's from the Noir Guy, and this is for everybody again. What obscure cartoon from the 80s needs a reboot and ongoing comic series?
I can answer this one pretty clearly just because it was my childhood favorite, Chippendale's Rescue Rangers, because a team of animal private detectives fighting organized crime led by animals in generic New York City with a ship that's made out of inflatable balloons and has plunger harpoons is basically, like, that's what more do you need? That's just fantastic. That's all you
need. It's weird that you just said a bunch of stuff, but all I heard was, I have inappropriate feelings for Gadget the Mouse.
Hey, also Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers had, like, the best NES game of any.
Oh,
well, except for DuckTales.
Well, not as good as DuckTales.
Not as good as DuckTales. But
besides DuckTales.
Yeah.
Yeah, but no, that game was awesome.
Oh, man. I fondly remember that show. And Gadget, yes. Along with every other character. You know, Chip and Dave? That was funnier in my head.
That show had a lot of weird, like, I think, unintended sexual stuff in it. Strictly because the name was Chippendale.
Oh, God, yes.
And the fly was named Zipper.
Boy, oh boy. Okay.
Oh, let's not go any further down that road.
Yeah, Chris, what show would you like to see make a comeback?
I mean, mine would be Gem, really, but like,
well, I got good news for you. Like,
the Kelly Thompson Sophie Campbell comic that's coming out now, like, the second issue came out this week, and it's literally everything I want Gem to be. Every problem I have with Gem, which is a show that I deeply love, like, is fixed in that comic, and it looks amazing. And that comic existing has ended the need for me to ever experience Gem in other media, which sucks because there's a movie coming out later this year. I don't know. Beyond that, like, you know, I know there was a, like, there's Masters of the Universe stuff, but our good friend Dylan Taub was talking about how he wished there was Master of the Universe stuff that was less Conan and more Jack Kirby, which I think would really get me more interested in it. And because that's the, you know, we talked about that Hordak comic when it came out all those, you know, years ago, and how much we both really liked that one tiny piece of Master of the Universe. I was a big fan of Mask when I was a kid, though, which we've talked about on Movie Fighters. It's garbage. It's complete garbage, but I do think that is a cool concept that you could do some fun stuff with in a comic or a show.
Yeah, similarly, I think I'm pretty sure Silverhawks doesn't hold up at all. But I had a Silverhawks lunchbox for a long time, and just to justify my memories of that lunchbox, doing something with that concept would be cool. Another show, I think this was a 90s show, but another show that I would just like to see revived in some weird way, because it was such a weird show to begin with, was, I believe it was just like a one season show that I watched every afternoon that one season called Cops. Kind of a G.I. Joe ripoff, but they were cops instead of soldiers.
I loved Cops back in the day.
There was like a bad guy who had a like an exposed brain under a glass dome, and everybody was just like crazy exaggerated looking. They looked like character designs from The Tick, but it wasn't a funny show.
I'm looking it up right now. I never heard of this thing. This is bizarre.
I had a
bunch of the toys.
Yeah, it was a crazy show, but I liked it. All right, I think that's it for our interview segment. Ted Anderson, it has been a pleasure and a delight to have you on the show. Before we let you go, please tell all our listeners where they can find you on the internet.
You can find me on Twitter and Tumblr both. I'm at Tedley Anderson. That's T-E-D-L-Y A-N-D-E-R-S-O-N. You can also follow my other comics project that I've been working on as a pitch right now, Spark. At spark-comic.tumblr.com. I am super excited about that one, and actually, if we had more time, I would want to talk about that because I'm really super excited. I know you guys would love it. Please follow there. I have other projects in the works that will be coming up sometime in the near future. I have like 4 different webcomics projects that all might be launching within like a month, which is ridiculous. Yeah, tedleyanderson.tumblr.com is the best place to find me.
And we'll have to have you on to talk about Spark sometime in the very near future.
Absolutely, yes.
Ted Anderson has been our guest, everybody. Ted, thanks again. We really appreciate you coming on.
Thanks. It was my pleasure, guys.
Thanks once again to Ted Anderson. We learned nothing. I don't think we're any better than where we started in terms of understanding Equestria Girls. But perhaps we can help you reach some understanding as we answer your listener questions.
That's right. We've got a couple that we're going to answer here. The first one I have is from Event Fatigue, who asks, have you guys ever had the problem of losing interest in the new work of a particular creator who you used to love? And if so, was it just a matter of your taste changing, the creator's work declining, or some combination of the two?
Yeah, I think that's definitely happened.
I can tell you who. Very quickly.
Okay.
It's Brian Bendis.
For me, it's been, like, it's happened a bunch. And I think, you know, I make jokes about being into the same stuff that I was into when I was 12, which, generally speaking, is true. Like, it's still pro wrestling and comics and video games. But there's certainly comics, you know, specifically in comics, there's certainly comics that you read and then revisit and they don't hold up. Or you read something and then you read the thing that came before it and realize, like, oh, no, this is the good one. It's always a pleasant surprise when something does hold up. Like, Batman the Animated Series is great. It's still great. It's always going to be good. That's the amazing thing.
Yep. I don't think there will ever be a time when Batman the Animated Series is not good.
But, I mean, it's like, you know, you don't like the same music that you – well, I mean – all we do is listen to mid-90s hip-hop, so...
Hey, I listen to early 2000s hip-hop.
Okay. I went back into... I've been, you know, I talked about listening to those, like, YouTube playlists. And which one was I talking about that came on? The Real Slim Shady.
Oh, yeah.
It came on. That song does not hold up. Like, I wasn't a huge fan of it in 96 or whatever, but man, that does not hold up.
Well, I'll say for my sake, you know, about Brian Bendis, it's not that his old work doesn't hold up. I think Alias is still good. I think some of his early, like, Torso is still pretty good. I think some of those Ultimate Spider-Man issues that he did, even though they move pretty slow, are well realized, and those characters are really well thought out. I think the issue of what happened with Bendis, and I think it happened during his Daredevil run, is that somewhere along the way, he got into, like, all right, I just got to fill out this issue so I could make this arc a six-issue arc. Like, I even think that Power... like, I think Powers is still good. At least... you know, at the beginning, I just think, you know, they're different different levels of Bendis. And there's like his Avengers run just didn't do much for me at all. But I've read some of his X-Men stuff that he's been doing lately, and I like it a lot. I think some of it is really like clever and has some good ideas in it. So it's not even like that Bendis changed or that I changed. It's just that some of his work I like and some of it I don't as much.
I mean, at one point,
I was like, everything he does I like. And then I was kind of like, I guess not.
I mean, I've certainly run into that. You know, if you listen to the Every Story Ever episodes, you know, I've talked about Neil Gaiman, you know, how much I really, really like Sandman. And how I think, you know, I haven't gone back and revisited it any time, but I did buy, like, all four of those leather-bound Absolute Sandman volumes at one point, and I do not have them anymore. And I think that's a matter of – I think that's both. I think that's my taste changing and Gaiman's focus as a writer and what he's interested in writing about changing. And also that, you know, there are certain creators that you like on certain things more than you like – on other things. Like, there are some people who I think have a really good handle on Batman. There are some people who do not have a really good handle on Batman, but maybe they're really good at Superman. I mean, Mark Miller is one. Yeah. Like, I still love the Superman Adventures issues that he wrote. And a lot of the stuff that he co-wrote with Morrison, like Aztec and JLA. Like,
There's definitely some Miller stuff, though, that, like, I remember liking at the time. That I definitely do not have that opinion of now. A lot of Ultimates, and even his Authority run to a point.
Alan Moore is another good example. I love a lot of Alan Moore comics, but I feel like there are Alan Moore's recent output does nothing for me. You know, right. Like
even the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen stuff.
Yeah, and I loved League Volume 1, and I really like League Volume 2 a lot, but I ended up hating Century. I hated it. And that's, you know, same two guys in a relatively short time span. And it's just like what he is writing about in Century is something I have no interest in him whatsoever. Frank Miller is a big one.
Yeah, I think we could keep going. So like, definitely the answer is yes.
But yeah, I think there is a matter of your taste changing as you grow. Because you know, you do change. You grow, you change, you experience new things, and that changes the way you feel about things. But it's also that, you know, that is happening to everyone around you at the same time. So your favorite writers are changing too. Your favorite artists are changing too.
I mean, I with Alan Moore, I feel like Alan Moore changed, right?
Yeah.
There's a difference between his output in one time and his output later.
Yeah. And there's like four different Alan Moores, you know?
Yeah.
There's like early 80s Alan Moore, there's mid 80s Alan Moore, there's Alan Moore who goes away and then comes back and does Tom Strong, which is great.
But then with like Mark Miller, we changed.
Yeah.
You know, like Wanted is the same comic, but I don't feel the same way about it that I did.
I still think. When I hit that last page of Wanted, I did have like a grudging respect for it where I was like, you got me. I bought every issue of this.
All right. One more question. This is from an anonymous questioner. We've often said that the best Thor run is Walter Simonson.
Mm-hmm.
This person wants to know who has the second best Thor run.
Lee and Kirby.
Yeah. I mean, one that has a special place in my heart is that Dan Jurgens, John Romita Jr. run.
Oh, that's got that great fight with Thanos, too.
There's some good shit in that run.
there is, and nobody ever talks about it because it's a weird Heroes Return run.
It was Thor's first ever number one issue.
Yeah.
Because that title just spun out of Journey into Mystery. Initially.
And then there was no Heroes Reborn Thor. He was just in the Avengers book.
That's right. I love that Jurgens John Romita run. You got to give it to Lee and Kirby, I think.
I feel like there's good issues of Thor. Like, outside of the Simonson run and outside of the Lee and Kirby run, like, there's good issues that I remember more than I remember good runs. like, the Simonson run, like, up till the Zaniac showing up, is, like, pretty 100% solid.
Like, I mean, the probably the best run since, or the most you hear anybody talking about, you know, Thor runs, is Jason Aaron.
Yeah, and that stuff's good. But, like, you know, Tom DeFalco and Ron Frenz were on that book for a real long time, and they do that amazing issue where Thor fights the Celestial that's, like, really good, but it's, like one really, really good issue in a run that I am not, like, a huge fan of.
Yeah.
You know, but, again, those dudes follow Walt Simonson. Like, those dudes, you know, Tom DeFalco and Ron Frenz are, like, following up the run that even at the time everybody was like, well, this is the best it's ever going to be. Like, those poor guys. But yeah, like, go find that fight with Thanos that's in Thor 25. This is the Romita and Jurgens run. And then go find that fight with the Celestial. I can't remember which issue that is, but it's Thor fighting the Celestial.
Look,
it's awesome.
I'll rep for even more of that Jurgens Romita Jr. run. I think there's a lot to like about it. But yes, that fight with Thanos is extra good. But yeah, we've probably got to give the better run to Lee and Kirby, the second best run. All right, that's going to be our question segment for this week. If you would like to send us a question, you can do so at our Tumblr, which is warrocketpodcast.tumblr.com. You can also email questions to us or Every Story Ever lists. We put up our Every Story Ever special for the month of April on the last day of April. Yeah, we got it in just in time. You can send us an Every Story Ever list at warrocketpodcast@gmail.com. You could also send us quotes lists and comments and whatever else you want to do there. Be sure to check out our website, which is warrocketajax.com. That's where you can download the show, stream the show, read show notes, and leave comments. Be sure to check us out on iTunes. If you go to iTunes and you search for War Rocket Ajax, you'll find the show. If you like the show, leave us a review there. The more good reviews we get, the more we are featured. And now we've reached the part of the show where we tell you all the different places you can find us on the internet. For me, all you have to do is go to about.me/MattDWilson, and you will find links to all my stuff, including my new Twitter handle, which is TheMattDWilson. Chris, where can everybody find your stuff?
Everybody can find me at about.me/ChrisSims. You can, of course, find me on twitter.com/theISB and at theisb.tumblr.com. And that is about it. Also, X-Men 92 is coming this month. I am not sure what the exact release date is, but digitally it will be out at the end of May. So be on the lookout for that. I'm very excited about it. Chad is very excited. I hope Scott Koblish and Pepe Larraz are very excited about it. But yeah, it's going to be a whole lot of fun. That first issue was a real blast to write. We have come to the end of War Rocket Ajax number 252. The new 252. Be here next week. We've got a great guest lined up for next week's show. We will tell you all about it in 1 week's time. Thank you for listening. If you are a Patreon backer, thank you. We hope you're enjoying the bonus content, and don't forget to send us a suggestion on some other things you'd like to see from us as the Patreon campaign continues. And that's it. Have a great week, everybody.
Yeah!
Hello, everybody, and welcome to War Rocket Ajax. It's the internet. All right, let's take two on that, buddy.